Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You're listening to Well Now, Slate's podcast on health and wellness. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. Since the COVID-19 pandemic began, it is estimated, Maya, that potentially tens of millions of people, perhaps even more, who were infected with COVID-19 have developed what we now come to know as long COVID. It often involves a range of disabling symptoms, everything from brain fog, fatigue, dizziness, cognitive impairment, strange neural symptoms that can come and go, lasting seconds to months, and above all, emotional depth and depression that it's been hard for me to even describe as we're still seeing it unfold.
And while doctors and other allied health professionals are still grappling with how best to treat long COVID, many patients, their lives have simply been turned upside down.
I had a very full life before I got sick. Long COVID has affected every part of my life now.
Rachel Beal testified earlier this year before the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. And she discussed how the illness of long COVID has impacted her and her family.
My kids have grown accustomed to me being sick. We plan things around how I feel and my energy level. If there's something coming up, like a birthday or a holiday, I try to get as much rest as I can before the event. I know that I will have a crash for the next few days after, and I won't be able to do much but sleep. Sometimes it takes several weeks for me to get back to my baseline.
In that same hearing, doctors explained the struggles and frustrations they've encountered when trying to give the best care they can for their patients.
These people have nothing to really lean on for curative treatment, nothing, zero. Zero FDA-approved medications for the treatment of long COVID. This must change. It's not beyond the might and the prowess of American medicine to solve this problem. It's absolutely not.
So we're continuing our conversation, marking the fourth anniversary of the pandemic, by diving deep into the impacts of long COVID on wellness.
Maya, I want to start by asking about the long COVID patients you've encountered in your work. What are some of the threads or stories, and just how are they presenting, and how has that affected the care you've given them?
So Kavita, it's really interesting. We've had people who've come to us with debilitating fatigue and neurological changes, and what they're saying is they can't even leave their apartment, much less their bedroom. And what they're looking for is solutions around how to actually feed themselves. Some of the patients that we're seeing, in addition to these debilitating symptoms that are really kind of making it hard for them to be mobile, are also experiencing changes in their blood sugar regulation. So people who didn't have diabetes before are showing up with prediabetes or insulin resistance in addition to this inability to move around. And so what they're trying to do is figure out, how do I nourish myself to keep my blood sugars level, and you know, how do I nourish myself when I am completely exhausted? It is like nothing we've ever seen before. And it's interesting because many of them are not coming with a long COVID diagnosis. The diagnosis is, I don't know what's happening. I've gone to physicians. I've gone for a number of tests. And they'll even say, I can't figure out why and what is going on. And so they turn to nutrition, and we're just trying to figure out how to help them nourish themselves in a realistic way. What about you, Kavita?
Well, I see people in probably about three different categories. The first are people who actually have been recently diagnosed with COVID. So they're not technically long COVID. You need to have at least 4 weeks since you've had your symptoms abate, or since you've kind of been out of isolation. And so there is technically a time window. But I see all too often too many patients who are diagnosed with COVID, or even come in and I make the diagnosis, and then I've offered them treatments, which we now know have been helpful in preventing or at least decreasing the potential of long COVID. And people simply don't feel, I've had many say, I don't think I'll get long COVID. I'm pretty healthy otherwise. And so that's one category. And that's actually quite a few people, especially recently. The second are people for whom we've had, I mean, diabetes is the perfect example, Maya, new onset diabetics. They might also be overweight or obese. They might also have other critical risk factors, but it is a new diagnosis for them, kind of out of the blue. And then when you probe and you ask if they've had COVID in the past, they say, oh, yeah, I did. I was infected X weeks ago, X months ago, some X years ago, and they might have had a diagnosis of diabetes they didn't know about, to be honest. And so that's another category. And then the third category are people that I think we'll get into with today's guest who were hospitalized with COVID, especially early on, some young, some old, all ages, some kids, who are presenting now with just strange, ongoing, vague symptoms. I call long COVID a diagnosis of exclusion because we have to eliminate everything else. We have to eliminate every organ and every system in the body in order to make sure that we don't, you know, mistakenly call something long COVID when it could be rheumatoid arthritis. And now what we're finding in the science is that there's an incredible link between inflammation, long COVID, and the original COVID infection itself, meaning once you're infected with the virus, that there's remaining lingering effects of the virus, even if it has completely cleared your bloodstream, and that the antibodies potentially that your body naturally makes are getting reactivated by these inflammatory signals. And I will say, Maya, I can't say this enough, it's a totally new virus. Never before have we seen this virus, and I hope we don't see something like this again. But it's so difficult for me to say this isn't a big deal when we don't know.
And that's the, I think, the part that's so hard for folks to wrap their head around because, you know, the initial messaging was, well, if you're healthy, this is not a big deal. When in fact, your baseline may help you, but it may not be the predictor of whether or not you experience long COVID.
There's still so much more we want to discuss about this, Maya. You're right. We could spend days on this. But let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to dive deeper into this with someone who's been caring and advocating for long COVID patients since they began showing up in his ICU 4 years ago.
What we have on our hands is a public health crisis, which has not been adequately defined by the medical community or our leaders in government, et cetera. We're dealing with almost an underbelly of society that crosses cultural and socioeconomic backgrounds. So rich people, poor people, black people, white people, children, old people, anybody is at risk to get this problem.
Caring for long COVID after the break.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now. I'm Maya Feller.
And I'm Kavita Patel. We're continuing our conversation, marking the anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic with Dr. Wes Ely. He's an ICU physician based in Nashville, Tennessee at Vanderbilt University, and the co-director of the Vanderbilt University Critical Illness, Brain Dysfunction, and Survivorship Center. He is also the author of an excellent book that I've read and drawn from called Every Deep Drawn Breath, A Critical Care Doctor on Healing, Recovery, and Transforming Medicine in the ICU. Wes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you today.
Wes, we start off our discussions by asking our guests how they define wellness. This isn't a gotcha question. We just want to know, Wes, what does wellness mean to you?
When I talk about wellness for myself or my patients, I think about how can a person reach a state of balance in life where they're living their best life, where they're living in a way that helps them on any given day, on every given day, stay in the present moment and really dive deep into the isness of where they are in life, regardless of what's happening around them. Almost, Kavita, in a way where you could say to yourself, I don't even judge anything anymore as good or bad. It just is, and I can accept that.
I love that. I literally have to write down sometimes the Wes-isms, and isness is one of them. Wes, we're having this conversation. I'm taking a deep breath because it's really hard for me to have this conversation thinking not just about the four-year mark of COVID-19 being declared a pandemic, but there's so much emotion. I know we're all feeling it. Wes, I want you to take us back 4 years ago, thinking about the front lines of this as an ICU physician. Tell us what was happening, what that question brings up for you.
I'll tell you two stories. The pain of walking into the hospital every day on the ground floor and knowing I'm about to take an elevator up to the eighth floor at Vanderbilt University ICU. And when I get off that elevator, there's going to be so much suffering. And people are going to be essentially locked behind glass without the people that they love the most, in a way that their illness is bringing them to a place, partly because of something I'm doing, partly because of the management that I'm providing, which is with sedation and immobilization, that allows them to forget their why to live. So that an actual person, an entire inestimable, priceless person, can be sitting in a bed and has no idea why they are on the earth anymore because nobody's there to remind them of it. That to me is intense pain. It's anti-medicine, and it's a way that I've allowed myself to live, and I never want to live that way again. The other thing, though, that I'll bring up is that in the middle of the night during acute COVID, we were conducting a federally funded, NIH-funded research project where we were collecting the brains of people who died. And so I found myself for the first time in 30 years of research doing something that I will say to this day is the hardest communication I've ever had with patients and families, where a patient who I had seen in the day would die. And that night, I would have to call the family members, not just to say, you weren't there because we didn't let you be there and your husband died, and then say to them, and in addition to that, we want to understand this disease process, and would he prefer, would he want, and would you want us to then allow him to have a brain donation where we would actually take his brain and put it into our study. That is a brutal sequence of things to have to communicate to a person over the phone. So that's the kind of trauma that comes back to me and the moral injury where I think, am I even a good person right now?
That is, I'm here to say that that is a completely understandable moral injury. And I think we all can share so many aspects of it. And Wes, I'm here to say, not only are you a good person, you're a great person because you're bringing that moral injury into question. I think often as clinicians, Maya and I talk about this, we don't bring that in enough. And I think that being able to think about it, as painful as it is exactly what we need to be doing. And we need to continue that. And I know you will, even past COVID. But thank you for sharing that. I know that still brings up a lot, and it'll bring up a lot in the future as well.
Yeah, I agree, Kavita and Wes, thank you so much. You know, it's a lot to grapple with and to really wrestle with the reality of what happened and the fallout for every single one of us in this, I don't even want to call it post-COVID because we're still in it, right? But in a different way. And it is really honest and truthful of you, especially as someone who's so dedicated to really caring for people, to share in such an intimate way. So thank you. And I know as a physician that a lot of your work involves caring for people who have this condition called PICS, post-intensive care syndrome. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and then how it's actually related to COVID?
Well, when you ask that question to me, Maya, I just immediately think of Ray Fugit, and I have permission to use his name. And any people's names that I use in this conversation, I have their written permission. Ray was a reddish-haired guy who had COVID in my ICU. He had really bad lung failure. He was on a high flow nasal cannula, eventually got put on a ventilator. And we were so expecting him to die, and he didn't. And when he and his wife, Shelley, were able to get to a point of recovery that he went home, he thought, oh, this is great. I'll be fine. But Ray developed PICS, post-intensive care syndrome, which is the rapid acquisition of acquired dementia, ongoing problems with PTSD and depression, and then a muscle nerve disease neck down in your body that prevents you from essentially living and makes you physically disabled. So for months and years, Ray was on oxygen. His lungs were still damaged. He could not exercise the way he wanted to. He continued to gain weight. And he really was struggling mentally with, what is this new normal of mine?
I can only imagine kind of the shock of getting out to only discover that your body and your mind are physically forever changed. Can you talk to us a little bit about how those particular treatments that you utilize in that ICU setting can have an impact or lead to PICS?
Yes, this is a very important point for the public to understand, because you or your loved one might be in the ICU someday, and I would ask you to be an advocate for either yourself or for your loved one. You know, I remember a day in the COVID pandemic, at the height of the pandemic, one of our patients was behind the glass receiving an immense amount of sedation, immobilized. And this is a typical way that we treated patients with COVID, but it's also a typical way that back in the 1990s, we treated all of our ICU patients. Everybody was on a sedative drip, a morphine drip, and immobilized for many days on end. And we thought that this was the right thing to do, and that it was benevolent, meaning we were wishing good to try and help them not remember this experience. But what we found out over the years, in the last 25 years that we've studied this, is that that immobilization and that deep sedation actually creates brain injury and causes the muscle and nerve disease that the patients with PICS end up getting.
So can you walk us through how caring for patients with PICS turned into caring for patients with long COVID?
Oh, wow. This is another story of me being wrong. You might imagine that kind of what you see, you think you know. And when I saw these people in the ICU, and we've been studying the post-intensive care syndrome for 25 years, so we had helped define this acquired dementia, then I just thought when people were coming out of COVID that they had PICS. And so all these people were talking about long COVID, and I was saying, what? Like, no, they just don't know that this is PICS, because all I saw was the ICU. And then, Maya, this is what happened. People started coming to our research center here at Vanderbilt called the CIBS Center, Critical Illness Brain Dysfunction Survivorship Center. And they were saying, well, I never was hospitalized. I said, wait a minute, what? Oh, no, I got COVID at home. In fact, I had mild COVID. Or somebody would say, I had asymptomatic COVID. And I was fine for 3 months. And 100 days later, wham, I can't even think anymore. And to give you another example, I have this patient of mine who is a young engineer. He worked for Tesla, actually. And I have permission to use his story, Matt. And he says, well, there's different modes of suffering for me. For example, I have a car. I went out on the weekend, a beautiful day. I washed my car. I washed it real good, washed the wheels, dried it, put it in the garage. Felt okay the rest of the day. The next day, violently sick. I sat on the couch all day, could hardly get up to get food, super emotional, and it's just an awful way to live. And he goes on, Maya, to talk about how his brain, he says, brain fog? Are you kidding me? My brain, I have no intellectual capacity or energy to digest anything, and I can't be an engineer anymore. So this is a person who had mild COVID, was never hospitalized, and I was forced to realize how wrong I was, and that long COVID may have overlaps with PICS, but it is indeed its own distinct clinical entity. What we have on our hands is a public health crisis, which has not been adequately defined by the medical community or our leaders in government, et cetera. For the mats of the world, their entire life structure has been brought down and they're trying to rebuild it. We're dealing with almost an underbelly of society that crosses cultural and socioeconomic backgrounds. So rich people, poor people, black people, white people, children, old people, anybody is at risk to get this problem.
Let's take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to speak more with Dr. Wes Ely about caring for long COVID patients and what they need to do to support their overall wellness. Stay tuned. Kavita, if you're looking for even more conversations around what it really means to achieve wellness, then you have to check out Embodied, the award-winning podcast from our friends at North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. Each week, Embodied's award-winning reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to so-called taboo topics to help answer some important questions about our bodies and our society. And nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including strippers, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the history of hookup culture to how the self-help industry is profiting from our problems to how a schizophrenia diagnosis can impact intimacy. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out their recent episode about crying, why we do it, and why it often makes us feel better. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. You're listening to Well Now from Slate. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. We're continuing our conversation about long COVID with ICU physician Dr. Wes Ely. So when we talk about the science around long COVID and its effect on the body, you know, you've mentioned that it's constantly changing. Tell us what we currently know about the condition and what you've seen in some of your patients. Specifically, what symptoms are they showing up with?
Just imagine on a timeline that the way this goes is COVID infection, and that could be asymptomatic, it could be mild, moderate, or you know, even bad COVID infection in the ICU, and then it, continuous with that initial infection or discontinuous. You could have a honeymoon period for 100 days and then get the problems. And the diagnosis of long COVID is once you've had symptoms for 3 months or longer. So we want to say, you know, 90 days or more of ongoing symptoms. Okay, Houston, we've got a problem here. And the symptoms are things like ongoing breathing problems, profound fatigue, which we call PEM, post-exertional malaise. And then this issue of brain dysfunction where you can't think, you can't process, right? Your speed of thinking is severely impaired. It's like a brain that's swimming in molasses is the way some patients describe this. Profound problems with sleep and ongoing smell issues many people have, and then a bunch of GI problems, bloating, constipation. These are the symptoms of underlying disease processes in the brain. So you're losing, the person with long COVID is losing neurons. They have dysfunctional electrical firing in their brain. But they also have structural problems inside their lungs, inside their blood vessels, inside their kidneys. And they even get profound immune diseases like lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Sjogren's syndrome. So these are systemic problems that we used to think of as just autoimmune diseases that had no cause. But now what we're saying is that these were triggered by the initial viral infection.
What's your current protocol for treating long COVID patients? And I know that the way you and I met is because you've been helping doctors like me and other frontline workers. You've been teaching us along through COVID kind of what we should be doing for taking care of not just our long COVID patients, but you know, all the other myriads of conditions that come along with that, diabetes, et cetera, that some of the brain fog and the early signs of dementia. What do you do? What's your current treatment regimen if you have one?
What we do on a daily basis is we have to sit down with a person who is the expert of their own illness. I am not the expert of Matt's illness or Kelly Seeley's illness. Kelly, a patient of mine, 2 master's degrees, master's in fine arts, master's in health administration, and she leads the Memphis COVID response team. And she said to me, I'm moved by people who want to fix this. For people to say it's a mystery, and can you imagine what it feels like to be part of the mystery and no one knows what to do with you? She talks about her brain dysfunction and says, I'd get home and I'd be in conversations with my husband, my family, and it would feel literally like you pulled the plug out of the wall and my brain would just stop. So Kavita, in answer to your question, I sit down with a Kelly or a Matt and I say, tell me how you're suffering. And I want to dive into your chaos. And that's my definition of mercy. I want to provide mercy. Mercy for me is my willingness to dive into your chaos and provide lifting and healing. And since we don't have proven therapies for long COVID, I'm going to be willing to do things that are out on a limb that aren't proven, that other people might say is quackery, but I'm going to consider giving it a trial with you, what we call an N of one trial, where we can try it for 2 weeks to 4 weeks and see if it helps you or not, anywhere from nutraceuticals to vitamins to drugs that affect your platelet function, your blood vascular flow. Some people are getting replacement of plasma. The spectrum of things that people are doing is very large.
For the people who already have long COVID and they're in the middle of trying to figure out how to find treatment, you know, they can get in touch with you. But what about the folks who are like really suffering and they're uninsured or underinsured? What's your recommendation for them as they're seeking out care?
This is where I get really worried because there are so many people who are losing their homes, they're losing their jobs. They find that their families are in dire straits because people are getting divorced. And this is where people really need help. So, for example, we've hired social workers, and we have a woman here named Jenna McDonald, who her full-time job is to help people find disability insurance, disability services, a job, housing, et cetera. And what we want is to see launched nationally at major medical centers, what we call survivorship programs like this for patients with long COVID. We're working with some nonprofit groups who are going to be helping us to build this out on a larger scale, put it to scale across the country. So we can create these communities, Maya, because right now people don't have a place to turn. And when that happens, they are at risk to die by suicide. I mean, let's just be honest about this. And that is a total tragedy that we have got to do everything we can to try and prevent and head off at the pass.
And Wes, what has been the response of the patients? Because I'm sitting here listening to you as someone who has patients coming to my office saying, you know, I feel like my providers don't listen. And you're kneeling down, you're going on this journey with people, you're in an interdisciplinary group that is committing to dive deep in a personalized sense. What are the patients saying when they start this process and then like along the way?
Let me give you an example. So we have 2 women who run our long COVID clinic, Dr. Sapna Kripalani and Dr. Sarah Martin. These are some of the most empathetic, knowledgeable, and best listeners, physicians that I know. And they develop beautiful relationships with their patients who are aware that Dr. Kripalani and Dr. Martin don't think that they have all the answers. And perhaps that's exactly why they want to go to them. I remember a patient many years ago, and I have this story in every deep drawn breath. There was a man named Marcus Cobb. And Marcus came to me. He was blue. He had a hole in his heart. He had a congenital heart defect. And right in front of him, when I was discussing with him the possibility of a heart and lung transplantation, I started sweating, Maya. And I sweated and I sweated and I sweated. And I realized later I was sweating because I was insecure because I did not know what to do for Marcus. 3 years later, I walked in my clinic and Marcus was waiting for me. And I said, why are you here? And I thought I'd made a total ass out of myself. Sorry, excuse my French. And Marcus said, when you sweated, and I've never done that before or since, it was a one thing time for me. When you sweated, I knew that you didn't know. And then I knew I wanted you to be my doctor.
It is. It's hard not to be speechless. And it's very fitting that I had this ready. This wasn't even pre-planned, but mention your book, Every Deep Drawn Breath. And Wes, you have a line in there that I recall, and I pulled up my notes, and I believe this is from a nurse. It's not enough to keep people from dying. We have to save the life that they want to return to, the one they had before they came to us. And I thought that that was absolutely kind of when I reflect on how much of what we did in COVID felt, it truly did feel like true emergency kind of triage and just, okay, let's just try to make sure this person doesn't die. I don't know how many times we said that to each other. Let's just make sure this person doesn't die. And really your statement and this, that beautiful story just reminded me that we really want them to have that time, whatever date that was, you know, March 8th of 2020 or January of 2020 or whatever time before this started for them. And I feel like that's something that I feel like as physicians, and when I'm being honest, when you go ahead and reflect on time, that I don't know if I would even rate how I know that in terms of our public health system, how we've all done, we gave it, you know, 1,000%. How would you rate our response to kind of what we've done with long COVID at different levels? Let's start with, like, how would you rate our government's response to what we're doing right now for long COVID? You mentioned the NIH, you mentioned the research. I know you've been personally giving advice to the government. How would you rate our response to this in terms of long COVID?
I'm, by the way, a fairly middle of the road, not overtly political person, but I'm willing to do this. I think we're at a 6.5 at best, maybe a 6, meaning 5 is just barely making it. We are not in the moderate to excellent category. We're in the not quite okay. I think we're getting there. I mean, we are getting more funding. It's also true, though, that the large networks are bogged down with a lot of rigmarole, a lot of bureaucracy that is preventing people from getting answers. And so we have to somehow overcome that. I want to point out that I think that people feel like they're drowning. You know, I'll give you one last example. Since patients aren't with us today, I brought Bill into the room, Bill Jennings. He's in his 80s. And he said this, "I feel like within myself that I have to keep on swimming. I'm in the deep end of the pool. And if I don't keep swimming, I'll sink to the bottom and I'll drown." Let's just be honest about the fact that when we're walking down the aisle in the grocery store or in a park, that there are people next to us who have long COVID, which to us, it is an invisible illness. We can't see it on the outside of their body. So we're judging their outsides with our insides, and we think we've got problems, but we don't know that they are having all that list of diseases. The real hard thing to grapple with is that PICCs, long COVID, other ICCs, for the most part, are invisible to the people outside. And that's why when they go to a healthcare professional or they hear the government not funding something, they say, "You don't see me. I'm invisible to you. And yet I'm drowning," like Bill Jennings just said. So we're just going to have to force ourselves to acknowledge that millions of people have this disability and we've got to do better.
And with that, Wes, last week we talked about how so much of this country and the institutions have moved on, right? And you just illustrated this kind of, you know, silent disability that people are experiencing. So as a person, a physician who cares for people who can't just move on from the pandemic, what do you say for those who are like, "I just want to go back to the way of life before March 2020?
To paraphrase what I heard you just say is, what do I say to or think about people who say, "Look, I don't have long COVID. My life is okay. Why should I be bothered with the people now who say they're suffering? I can't see it anyway, and I just want to have my life the way it was before." I say, we are all connected. We are part of the human condition, and our humanness is the one thing that we have to grab a hold of. It's not our religions. It's not our politics. It's not our color or our education. It's the fact that each person is endowed with an amount of dignity. And this is regardless of what your belief system is. I believe that every single human being has this amount of dignity that must be respected. And so you can't be affected by long COVID and suffering and being considering taking your life by suicide and it not affect me in some way. And if I believe that I'm not affected by it, then my head is in the sand And I have a serious problem with awareness of what this life is all about.
Dr. Wes Ely is an ICU physician and the co-director of the Critical Illness, Brain Dysfunction, and Survivorship Center. Wes, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Maya. Thank you, Kavita.
That's Well Now for this week. Our show is produced by Vic Whitley-Berry. Ben Richmond is Slate's Senior Director of Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is Slate's Vice President of Audio.
If you have something you'd like us to cover, email the show at wellnow@slate.com. And be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss an episode. Join us next Wednesday for another conversation on health and wellness. I'm Kavita Patel.
And I'm Maya Feller. Thanks for listening.